When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. First, you probably know the bad news already. Mint has shut down. But here's the good news. There's a better alternative. Monarch Money. That's right. Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it. As a finance nerd, you would assume that I have my money game all together. Well, shocker, I didn't. Until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, help me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on things I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now you get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Monarch has a tool that allows you to easily import your data from Mint and keep all your tags and categories. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving the product. They release updates every 2 weeks and allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
All right, folks, welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Tonight, we have a special return guest. We have Eric from the Intelligent Investing podcast, who is also the founder of Granite State Management, Capital Management, Granite State Capital Management.
Yep.
Okay, there we go. Got it. All right, great. And he's back with us again to talk to us about stocks and the markets and lots of great stuff. So Eric's a smart dude, and this is going to be a fun conversation. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Eric, and let's go ahead and have a little chat.
Cool. Well, it's nice to be back on. How you guys been?
I've been good. You know, I did want to ask you before we jump in, because I follow you on Instagram, and I swear it's like once a week you're putting on some really nice looking piece of steak, whether it's, you know, I think you mentioned like grass fed or something, like whatever it is, and the way you're seasoning it, it reminds me that I need to up my red meat game. You know, I don't know if you ever watched the show Survivor. I know Dave's watched it.
A long time ago, yeah.
Okay, so they basically, they have a bunch of people starving on an island, and then they have them compete, and they'll have them compete for food. So sometimes they'll show, like, Outback Steakhouse on there. And, you know, they'll get really emotional. They'll start crying. And you know, that's kind of how I feel every time it's about my time to have a ribeye. So, you know, the question I have for you.
Yes.
Where are you getting these steaks, man?
Well, from several places, but my go-to is Costco, actually.
Love Costco ribeye.
Yeah, you know why Costco ribeye is so good?
No.
Because they blade tenderize it. It's the only place that blade tenderizes their meat.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's why it's soft and tender when you cook it. Even if you F it up a little bit.
I mean, yeah, like that's actually my parents' secret too when they barbecue at home. And yeah. You know, I love the different steaks at the different restaurants, but nothing beats that home Costco steak.
I mean, I buy it from Whole Foods too, and I think Costco's better most of the time.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and cheaper.
have you gotten a chance to get that Japanese Wago yet?
You know, so not from Costco because I don't really feel like spending like $100 on steaks, even though it's probably a good deal. But there's a in Philly where I'm at, there's a local hot pot place called the Chubby something, and they have an A5 Wagyu hot pot. You know, all kinds of steak, ribeyes, and short rib. And I mean, it's still expensive. You know, it's like $35, and you're getting these like super thin pieces of steak. I did it once, and I will tell you, I had never had A5 Wagyu before until like a couple months ago. Oh my god, it literally melts in your mouth. The fat is like butter. It's unbelievable. So if you can find a hot pot place that has it, it's fantastic.
I would have never thought of that. Yeah,
I know.
I have to add that to the to-do list.
Well, I asked the waitress, I said, is this going to be a waste of money? Am I going to taste any difference? This like thin piece of thing in boiling water. She's like, oh, yeah, you'll taste the difference. And yeah, it was awesome.
Interesting. Well, you know, I guess kind of in that realm. We had talked before about, you know, international opportunities.
Yeah, that was that was a great transition.
Speaking of Japan,
nice segue.
So well maybe done. You can talk to the average investor about what it's like to buy stocks, because you know Dave and I are primarily U.S. stocks guys. I mean, we know there are taxes involved when you look at companies outside of the U.S. So maybe you can talk about some of those implications.
Yeah. So for full disclosure, I am, you know, not a tax expert, so I'm not giving professional tax advice on the air. On occasion, you'll have some tax withholding or there's some special thing, but for the most part, it's just it's treating it as capital gains. And if you do a current, you know, when you convert to the yen, depending on how the U.S. dollar conversion to yen goes, you might have some gain or losses on the income. So you get like a currency sheet, so you have to declare income or losses for currency, but then you get a 1099 with the capital gains on it. So it's relatively straightforward. I think there was one situation in Israel where I had to have a whole ridiculous tax form, but that's really been the only instance, and I've been doing this for quite a while.
So there's no like let's say it's Japan for whatever reason. Like there's no extra taxes from the Japanese government and then from US. No?
No. Not that I know. I hope not.
dividends and capital gains and the same as you would in the U.S.
Well, the dividends, sometimes you'll see on the 1099 of like a dividend withholding tax. So like they might take, you know, a little bit out of the dividend. I don't know what the exact laws are for Japan. I know like in Canada, I get that, but yeah.
Interesting. Do you see opportunities out there? Like how do you parse focusing on, you know, U.S. stocks versus international opportunities? Or are you just always looking at the whole kind of pot?
So always looking at the whole pot. Certainly the lens that I'm looking at it is different. So like in Japan's weird, where historically and still to this day, it's still pretty much like that. You know, the corporate governance is really bad. And in Japan and South Korea to an extent as well, companies aren't always being run for the interest of shareholders. Sometimes there's even, you know, in Japan, I might be getting this wrong, so I apologize if anyone's Japan. In Japan can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but my understanding is that, you know, a lot of people still look at owning stocks as a form of gambling. And then in the Japanese market specifically, some people don't buy stocks because the dividends are like these like interesting little gifts. There's no word for it. I don't remember the word, you know, where you might get like movie tickets or you get some little perk. So there's certain like social benefits to this. When you say, oh, I'm a shareholder and so-and-so company, there's a pride to it. And then a lot of Japanese companies, they're being run for things other than shareholder value. So they might be being run for longevity and for, you know, for honor, right? There's a big honor culture, so there's a pride and honor of, you know, this is what we do. We've been in business for 673 years, and we own, you know, 19 golf courses and a fishery, and, you know, but our main business is in handbags or something. So you see a lot of weird stuff. Generally, the returns on capital or returns on equity are pretty low for a lot of these businesses because they own, say, again, you have X of book value in the main operating business, then 10X in real estate that has just been on the books for, you know, 800 years. So you see situations like that all the time. So the lens that I'm looking at when I'm say buying Japanese stocks, that I'm typically taking a basket approach, and I'm generally buying them really cheap. You know, so I always think it's humorous. Occasionally I'll come across one of these write-ups saying, oh, you know, the stock's trading at, you know, it's a quality business. It's trading at 12 times earnings, and it's hovering right around cash. So you're, you know, don't worry about it because, you know, you have your cushion for cash. It's like, well, do you know how many times I've owned a Japanese stock trading below net cash? Like, those things can change pretty, you know, pretty quickly. And if that business ever has a, you know, a turn for the worse, you can easily see a stock trade below net cash in Japan. But generally, you know, it's interesting, if you look at, and of course, this is back testing, but if you look at, like, you know, during those few decades where the Japanese market went nowhere, you know, if you had just bought, say, a typical Ben Graham net stock approach in Japan, you would have compounded, you know, in the low teens, where the Japanese market did nothing. So that's kind of interesting. I've done pretty well in Japan. And again, mostly buying these businesses that are not very profitable, not very interesting. Occasionally you'll get one pop, like 75% in a day, and I'll sell into the volume. But I take a basket approach. There is one Japanese stock that I do own a larger position in that's larger than just a typical basket. But in that case, you know, the management does have a good track record, and they've been very ethical, and the stock's trading, it's a growth company trading like 5x earnings. And, you know, that's actually been one of my worst investments. I've owned it for a little over a year and it's gone nowhere, where my basket has done a lot better than that over the last few years. So we'll see.
How big is the basket? So, you know, people get a sense of kind of this idea of digging in the trash and finding really, really cheap stuff.
I'd have to look. It might be like 30-40% of the portfolios that I manage are in these basket of, you know, micro cap cheap stocks.
Like, number of stocks wise, are we talking like in the 5 to 10 or like 15 to 20 or
for the basket
100? Yeah,
maybe like depending on the client, maybe like 10 to 25.
Yeah,
and then so there are things that I'm looking for. I'm not just indiscriminately buying net nets. So there are things I'm looking for. So for instance, with Japanese stocks, I tend to look for businesses that are not burning a lot of cash. They don't have to be profitable. Actually, unprofitable net nets tend to outperform profitable net nets, interestingly enough, and companies that pay dividends underperform companies that don't pay dividends from a basket approach. But, you know, they're not burning a lot of cash. They're not selling stock. That's like a huge red flag if you see a stock trading below net cash and they're selling stock. And then typically too, you know, another red flag is, say, if they have a lot of their main operations might be in China. It doesn't mean anything inherently, but by avoiding, say, Japanese stocks with large operations in China, I'm removing a lot of fraud risk. And I mean, if you look at China over the last few decades, right, you know, look, the news cycle is always, especially today, right, the news cycle is very clickbaity. It's always, how can I have the most negative headline possible to get the most clicks?
Bleeds and leads.
Yeah. So typically when you read anything about China, it's usually pretty bad. I've just seen Chinese frauds where you can just get killed and they looked optically cheap until they went to zero.
So I guess keeping in the Far East,
yeah,
we talked a little bit about off air before we came on about Charlie Munger and some of his thoughts on China.
Yeah.
So do you want to touch on that live wire?
Yeah, or sure. Sure. That they're doing something corrupt, and the truth is, like, there's a lot of stuff that China does that's pretty bad. But there's a lot of stuff they have done that's pretty good. Especially it's become a lot more of a capitalistic society. There's been, I don't know the numbers, but the amount of people that have been taken out of poverty over the last few decades is staggering. So China is in a much better position financially, and the people are have a much better standard of living on average today than they did 30 or 40 years ago. And I think that trend is just continuing, but it's going to take time, right? I mean, they're they're much newer to market than the United States is. So I think generally I agree with Charlie Munger that China has a great future ahead of it. But you'll also notice that most of his Chinese investments are done through a fund managed by Li Lu, who is, knows Chinese. He is Chinese and knows the culture and is able to, have a much better boots on the ground understanding of China. And I think you need more of that because I mean, I have seen situations. I'll tell you a story actually. So when was this? This might've been like 2006, 2007. And I had invested in a company called China Media Express, and they had their business where they made billboards for like buses. So if you like see those buses, large advertisements. And why I invested in them is that, they were very profitable, huge returns on equity. I'm talking like 40-50% returns on equity, large growth rates, and they were significantly more profitable and higher ROEs, higher margins than all their competitors. Also traded below net cash. So I was like, this is a no-brainer. And there was some other large investor that was well known that was also investing in the company. So it made me feel a little bit better. And it just got weird. It was like, why is the thing trading below net cash? What's going on here? And I had called, if you went on their website, they had all their clients and one of them was Coca-Cola. So I called investor relations for Coca-Cola, and I didn't really know who to leave a message for, but I was just saying, hey, there's a company I'm invested in, supposedly you're a client, just wanted some, more light on the relationship. And the head of marketing for Coca-Cola called me back, and she said, we haven't heard of this company, but that doesn't inherently mean we're not working with them. It could be one of like our local, Chinese bottling companies that works for them. I will look into it and see if there's any, sort of local Coca-Cola related companies that might be working with them. She calls me back 2 weeks later and says, no, I can't get in touch with anyone in China that knows this business. So I'm like, okay, that's strange. And I sold the stock right after I heard this. I was like, that freaked me out.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a Seeking Alpha article of some guy who like had went to China and he was a shareholder and he went to headquarters to like meet with the CEO. And he like walks in and there's like a few people sitting around playing like ping pong, but like no one's doing any work. And he was just like, or it was pool or whatever, but it did not compute to him. Like what was going on? Like how could this be a real business?
Right.
Anyway, it turned out the entire thing was a fraud. To the point that they faked the cash in their bank account. So the cash wasn't even real.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Right. So that's an extreme example, right? But you see Chinese frauds all the time. And I actually did some research into Chinese net nets. And I was thinking, well, maybe, if you bought a basket, right, it takes, the fact is maybe you're getting paid to take on that risk. Because, as value investors, sometimes, right, just kind of like unprofitable net nets do better than profitable net nets. But I thought maybe Chinese net nets actually do incredible. And you have a few frauds, but the other ones go up 1,000%. Well, it turns out that owning a portfolio of net nets, if you exclude China, you do better. So,
that's funny.
Right. So it's just hard. I think if you're not on the ground, because there is still a lot of fraud, if you're not in China or speak Chinese or have connections in China, it makes the game harder. And I think there's other opportunities that aren't as hard and that you don't get bonus points for making harder investments. So I avoid China, but generally I'm bullish on the country of China. I just, as an investor, I don't invest in China.
So what do you think of like the Alibabas and the Tencents and any of that kind of stuff? What are your thoughts on any of those companies?
Yeah, I mean, they seem good. I don't know. I'm actually reading a book right now on the founder of Alibaba, but I don't know if that's gonna help me or not. Right. With an investment, but I just think it's interesting. But I would imagine, right, Charlie speaks to Lilu all the time. I would imagine there's probably some insight that he has.
Yeah.
You know, when Charlie Munger said it's just a replacement for Cash, of course he's, you know, Charlie being Charlie, he's going to play it down. He's not going to just buy any random company as a replacement for Cash, right? He's not,
right.
You know, so obviously there's something he likes about it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I remember reading this was less than 12 months ago, probably. It was not just some small no-name Chinese company either. It was Luckin Coffee?
Coffee,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awful, you know, the fraud that they had with that. And I guess there was some boots on the ground firm that was kind of checking in on the company's numbers. And they're like, there's no way, like even just looking outside of these coffee restaurants, there's no way that with the flow of traffic that they're getting anywhere near what they were reporting. So this is not just like a one or two off thing. This is a big thing. And what's sad is that was one of the companies I saw a lot around the internet of people saying, you know, get in on this. This is the Starbucks of China.
Right.
And it completely blew up. It's awful.
Right. I mean, could you imagine if like Starbucks all of a sudden one day went away or McDonald's? It's like, that's not going to happen.
Right. Oh. Well, you know, everybody wants to call the SEC the bad guy, but there are good things to having those kind of regulations in place,
sure.
Which, you know, for me personally makes me kind of timid about going outside of the US, but at the same time, like you're saying, if there's, you know, countries where that's not a problem, like Japan.
I mean, with Japan specifically, you know, if you were committing financial fraud in Japan, it would be a very dishonorable thing. Right. And there's certain social clout by running a public company in Japan. So, but a lot of these companies, they're not, again, not being run for shareholders, they're being run for longevity.
In time, like you're saying, if there's, you know, countries where that's not a problem, like Japan.
I mean, with Japan specifically, you know, if you were committing financial fraud in Japan, it would be a very dishonorable thing. Right. And there's certain social clout by running a public company in Japan. So, but a lot of these companies, they're not, again, not being run for shareholders, they're being run for longevity.
So different idea.
Yeah.
Let's face it. A vibrant sex life contributes significantly to your overall happiness and confidence, but sometimes your hectic schedule doesn't leave room for doctor visits. That's where Hims steps in. With their convenient and discreet online platform, you can receive treatment for erectile dysfunction from the comfort and privacy of your own home. No more waiting rooms, no more awkward conversations, just a simple, direct path to treatment that works around your life, not interrupts it. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance is needed. If ED is getting you down, it's time you join hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at Hims.com/investing. That's Hims.com/investing for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/investing. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription needed. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Okay, so let's kind of do a really rough segue. All right, let's segue off of China and some of the fraud stuff. And let's talk about the recent merger with Discovery and Time Warner and all that fun stuff. I will admit I don't know much about it, but okay. It sounds to me like you might. So maybe you could shed a little light on that subject for us.
Yeah, sure. So also full disclosure, I'm a shareholder, second time now around. So I had originally bought Discovery Communications a few years ago. I actually saw the only idea I've ever gotten from CNBC. John Malone happened to be doing an interview a few years ago and was talking about how he thought, you know, Discovery was probably pretty cheap at the time. It was trading at a really low multiple to free cash flow, and it was just being valued as a melting ice cube, right? You know, where the all the cord cutting and Discovery, the legacy business being tied to cable, you know, there was a concern it would just decline forever. But the thing, you know, the thing with Discovery that I liked originally, it's a very capital light business. You know, it doesn't take, you know, you don't need to hire actors, right? You can film some animals in a forest or something like that. And you have like $500,000 in production costs.
There's no zebra unions, right?
Exactly. Don't give anyone any ideas, though. There's some people, you know, I joke, but there's like, you know, some people, I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day about this, where it's like, you can come up with some really bad, like, government idea, and there'll actually be someone who wants to initiate it. So I don't even want to joke about zebra unions, because there's going to be some radical animal rights activist that says, oh, that's a great idea. and we're in the whole Discovery thesis. But with Discovery, yeah, so, you know, very capitalized business, and it just spits off free cash flow. So that's what, and it was trading a very, you know, a low multiple, basically, like it was going to just be declining forever. And I also like the fact that John Malone was a, you know, controlling shareholder. So that's why I bought it originally. The stock ran up a lot. I sold into that run up. I didn't sell at the high where it got into like the 70s. There was the, you know, the big liquidation that had happened with that fund. But anyway, you know, on May 17th, Discovery and Warner Media, which is owned by AT&T, announced they were going to be creating this global entertainment leader and combine. So the way the transaction would work is AT&T would spin off, basically would shed the Warner Media assets, and then Warner Media and all of Discovery would merge together. This would create literally one of the largest content libraries in the world with direct-to-consumer distribution. So
does HBO get bucketed into that?
Yeah.
CNN as well?
Yep. So you have HBO, CNN, you get sports rights, you get like the DC brands like Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all of that. And what's interesting is the combined company, you know, they're on target to spend together $20 billion. And to get sort of the extent of that, Netflix is guiding for 2021, $17 billion. Okay. So it's kind of a big, it's a huge deal. And if you're combining, you know, HBO Max with Discovery Plus, you know, I honestly think this is like a, you know, literally, you know, total home run here. I this is why I bought back into it. Now, I thought what would happen. See, I thought I heard about it, and I assume the stock would shoot up a bit. And there was a temporary, I think, like for the first day it went up, and it's now below the you know, when they announced. The stock has just sort of drifted down. So the market actually doesn't like this deal. And I can get into that if you'd like, yeah. Why I think that is.
Why do you think that is?
So I think there's a few reasons. I think one of the reasons is time to completion. So their estimate is going to take 2 years to do this deal. Wow. And, you know, so if you're an arbitrager on Wall Street, you know, this isn't something you can do in 2 months. And if you're someone who even just has a big job on Wall Street, to have a sort of this uncertainty for 2 years of what's going to happen, because a lot of things are going to happen in 2 years, I think a lot of people are not interested. And maybe even be selling it because they don't know what's going to happen in 2 years. There's also a possibility there's like just a technical overhang from the AT&T shareholders, because they're not going to be getting their dividend from the new entity. So what's possible is, I think there's probably some fear. Again, I don't know, but I'd say it's probable that there's a fear that once the merger happens, the AT&T shareholders might just indiscriminately sell the stock, which I'd be happy about. I would just buy more. I kind of hope that happens, but I think that's a concern. And then so I think just, probably the biggest, before, yeah.
Just to be clear, so from what it sounds like, because I don't know the situation, it sounds like you have AT&T, and then they're spinning off this Warner thing, and then the Warner entity is going to take over Discovery.
It's
shareholder, you're getting shares.
Yeah, so as a Discovery shareholder, you're getting shares, and you're gonna own a small percentage. Yeah, so let's see, the AT&T shareholders are gonna receive 71% of the new stock.
Okay, yeah. And Discovery's getting the other.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the third reason is, you know, it's gonna be a highly leveraged business, and you know they're looking. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're looking to deleverage to. Okay, so yeah, they're gonna look to deleverage to 3x EBITDA over time. But I think there's probably some concern that, you know, let's say Discovery Plus ends up being a flop, that the companies just are two melting ice cubes that combine. I don't think this is the case, but you know, if there were two melting ice cubes combining, now it's a gigantic melting ice cube, and now they have all this debt. And I think the concern is that because the company has so much debt, I don't think that's a problem because, again, this company spits out so much free cash flow. I was a Discovery shareholder when they merged with Scripps just like a few years ago. And with the Scripps deal, they had levered up to 5 times to get the deal done. And they were projecting they would get to about 3.5 times leverage in 2 years. And then once the merger closed, they had hit their leverage target in under a year. And the synergies were double what they originally projected. I mean, this is a bigger deal, obviously, but I just don't think this, I mean, Discovery Plus has been, you know, a total home run as well for them. So you're getting a business that's very, very cheaply valued. You know, right now the combined company would have, let me just take a look at my notes here. You know, it'd have a combined enterprise value of about $130 billion. And the, you know, the company is projecting in 2023 that they would have $14 billion in EBITDA. So you're basically, you know, it's going to go for like a little over 8 times enterprise value to EBITDA right now. And that's a pretty low valuation for a company that's actually growing and will have synergies. You know, if you had valued this, yeah. So yeah, it's a little over eight times enterprise value to EBITDA for 2023, you know, 12 times. So, you know, if you just said, okay, I think this company should be worth 12 times EBITDA, you'd get about 75% upside. And let's say there was real synergies and, you know, the synergies were really great and the valuation went to 15 times, you know, you're talking over 130% increase in the stock price. You know, I do think it's interesting too. So John Malone, who's the major shareholder, you know, for your listeners who don't know who he is, you know, he's probably the best media investor in history. There's a book, he wrote a book about him called Cable Cowboy, which I highly recommend. But he is someone who has used debt over the years to do a lot of financial engineering. And he likes to be in control of companies. He has actually come out in favor of the deal as a Discovery shareholder, and he's giving up control. So for Malone to give up control of something that he owns, he must love the deal. So I do put some weight on his press release that, and he also did an interview on CNBC the other day as well, which I recommend checking out.
So I guess along those lines, some of the things that I've heard certainly mirror everything you were saying. A couple of concerns I saw on Seeking Alpha the other day was a concern about AT&T's dividend being either cut or not being paid. And I think that was like rattling through Seeking Alpha like an earthquake. Yeah. And then there was also comments about the CEO for Time Warner would be actually leaving the company and the gentleman who runs Discovery would be the one taking over. And I think there was some concern that maybe he was not the right cowboy to lead the company, so to speak. So I guess, what are your thoughts on those two ideas?
Yeah, well, I think he's actually done a pretty good job at Discovery. But again, they're you know, Discovery Plus has done wonderful so far. You know, the company's, again, you know, a lot of cash flow, asset-light businesses. So maybe they find someone better when it happens. But even if they don't, I think you're gonna do pretty well. I think it's a very asymmetric bet. There's a lot of ways to win here, and it's priced like a melting ice cube. So I mean, that's the thing. It's so cheap that even if things just stayed the same, I would expect a higher valuation. And if the synergies work out better, yeah, I mean, I think the valuation goes up.
Yeah, I guess one of the things I wondered too was, you know, AT&T bought Time Warner for what, $73 million, not that long ago, and now they're kicking it out for $43 million. So, you know, it just seems like it's like one of those. It's like a basketball player that nobody really wants. They just seem to keep passing it between each other. So, how is that?
Yeah,
if that has any bearing on any of this?
Well, I mean, sure, but I think the combination though of what you're getting. I mean, you know, you look at Disney Plus, right? I don't know if you've ever used Disney Plus.
But oh, yeah. I got a 9-year-old.
Okay. So, you know, I used the trial. I actually watched a lot of the old stuff from when I was a kid, but it's pretty cool. Well, imagine now you turn on, you know, your whatever it is, Discovery Plus, and you have, you know, HBO Max and Discovery and Wonder. I mean, it's a pretty awesome content. Again, they're going to be spending more for content than Netflix. So, and then there's not a lot left. I mean, you don't have much left. So, I mean, I guess you could have a situation where Comcast could step in and and say, hey, we want to buy this, which would suck for Warner. That would be bad for Warner Media. You know, and actually, you know, in some weird twisted way, if Comcast wanted to say step in by Discovery, break off the deal, and then let like Warner Media struggle for a few years, then buy it for even cheaper, like that would be a good, yeah. You know. But yeah, I mean, I think Warner Media needs someone like a Discovery to merge with. Discovery is fine on its own right now, but it would be better, you know, some other content library.
Yeah, that's a good viewpoint. I like your idea. I'm gonna probably check into Discovery and see what I think about it. So
yeah, thanks for sharing. And just to address your point with the AT&T dividend cut too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're spinning off the Warner asset, so that new entity is not going to have a dividend. Right. So, I mean, at some point, AT&T will pay. I don't know if they will fully cut their dividend, but even if they do it, they'll pay it again. I mean, it's AT&T. Right. Most people who are investing in that business are doing it for, you know, the income stream. So they're not going to change that after, you know, 100 years or however long they've been around. But I think the real concern is, will those AT&T shareholders then just dump the new stock because that's not going to be getting a dividend? I'd say a lot of them probably will. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a good chance. That would be a buyer. I would buy from them at a lower price.
Yeah, it's a very good chance.
It's a concept Joel Greenblatt talks about. What was his book? I think You Can Be a Stock Market Genius.
Yeah.
Where a lot of times in spinoffs, the shareholders don't want whatever's being spun off, so they sell it, and it's a great buying opportunity.
Yeah, the problem by just doing spinoffs, though, indiscriminately, is ever since that book came out, the spinoff opportunity has been mostly arbitraged away. You know, if you had just been doing spinoffs since then, you actually haven't done so well. So, and a lot of the spinoffs also, this is what the other thing too, some of the spinoffs that are cheap is they're actually intentionally spinning off the junk.
Right.
You know, in this case, there's certain tax benefits too by having Warner Media spun out, so they don't have to pay taxes on it. It's a reverse Morris Trust or something like that.
And I guess in your case, if they do spin off Warner and you look at it and it's like, wow, they did put a lot of junk in here, you can always sell it because it was, you know, you got shares and you kind of got your payout because you got the premium as the company got bought out.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be so much cash flow coming from these two businesses that I don't think you'll do bad. You may not hit it out of the park, but I think your downside's pretty, like, not an investment advice, but from my opinion, I think the downside's pretty limited here. There's also a chance that in a few years that a new entity gets bought by someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're seeing a lot of consolidation. There's a lot of interesting things happening in the media industry. And I think if people are interested in it, the history of the media industry, like I'm reading a book about Sumner Redstone right now and Viacom.
Okay.
And it's fascinating just, you know, just a couple decades ago, well, maybe more a couple. But I mean, that used to be like the growth industry. And if you think of like how we look at the FANGs now, it's kind of how the cable operators were back then. And it's funny seeing that kind of life cycle. And so, you know, as you look around at all of the different change in media, are there any other opportunities you like, whether related to media or media technology or anything of that nature?
Yeah. And before I answer the question, I'll just leave with one thing too. Where while cable, right, legacy cable is slowly in decline, you know, the future is the subscription business. Hmm. You know, this is an opportunity for Discovery and Warner Media to sort of supercharge that together and have some, you know, real synergistic relationship. But that future is in the subscription business. And in terms of other technology, I mean, podcasting, and we're on a podcast, we are in the very early innings of podcasting. I think people might listen and watch old podcasts, you know, say 30, 40 years from now, the way that we watch, you know, like silent films, you know, where that was like the big thing back then. So whatever we're doing right now, we'll look back in 20, 30, 40 years and be like, wow, this was literally the beginning. They had no idea what was about to come. But I think if you are in the podcasting business, you are writing some industry growth for many, many, many years to come. So I am personal, my largest personal position. So I own it for my clients too, but from my personal account, even a larger position, it's in a Liberated Syndication whose main business is Libsyn, the podcast host. And that is a really interesting situation going on right there. So I could talk about that if you'd like.
Give us like the elevator pitch of somebody who doesn't know much about podcasting. Like, why would they be interested in a company like this?
So you have a business with a very, very sticky business with about 80,000 podcasters on it. One of the original podcasting hosts, so they have that first mover advantage. It is being run in a very, very efficient, capable manner. There's just been a big management shakeup. They're finding a new CEO right now, but salaries have come down a lot. There's an activist who shook things up and had the CFO and CEO removed from the company who were basically stealing from the company. It was egregious. And you're basically paying a very low, I don't remember the exact number offhand, but it wasn't much more than 10 times free cash flow for a company that, you know, could potentially be growing at 30-40%, you know, for the next 10 years. So you're paying very little for a high growth stock.
It's like a pure play on podcasting.
Totally. Yeah. They also, I mean, they do own Pear Networks too, which is like website hosting, but their main business is Libsyn.
So what makes podcasting so appealing?
Well, funny you ask on a podcast, you know,
ironic.
It's yeah. I mean, look at this, right? We're on a show right now, you know, so, you know, Andrew and Dave, how do you describe your show? Like, what's your show description?
Andrew?
Just a couple of guys who taught themselves how to invest and are trying to teach other people how to get started.
And the target audience is mostly for more beginners, right?
Yeah.
Right. So if I was someone who's interested in investing, you know, maybe a beginner just starting off, but like also intelligent, like the vibe I get is like you also are just intelligent beginners. You know, we have high level conversations as well. So there's a very, very niche specific audience that's listening to your show. And, you know, if you want to turn on the radio, you know, you kind of have to catch it when it's on. It might be sort of tailored more to the masses, right? So a lot of these, like, you know, Dave Ramsey's and Susie Orman and more like financial planning. But you have a very specific thing you do. And, you know, on my show, you know, well, shameless plug, it's generally more for more advanced investors. And there's this very specific niche of, I would say, highly sophisticated value investors that tend to listen to my show. So what's really cool is you can micro-target and build these little communities around your show, which is not impossible to do with radio, but it's harder. So there's a more personalized aspect to podcasting. It really brings power to anyone that has a message to share. And the other cool thing is that it's totally a meritocracy. You know, I don't have to be signed up to some big network to have my message shared. But, you know, if I keep sharing episodes and no one listens, you know, maybe I got to either step up my game or I'm not very good. However, with no budget and no marketing budget and nothing fancy, just a microphone and a laptop, you know, I can have people subscribe to the show, listen to the episodes, and so can you. And I think it really breaks up any of the corporate bureaucracy of radio and TV and really brings the power to the host. And I think that is an incredible thing for society, quite frankly. And listeners tend to love it.
Yeah, I'm 100% advocate on podcasting. I mean, you know, I was a podcast listener before I became a podcast host, you know,
likewise.
And everything
you're
saying is, it's amazing that the depth that a podcast can go into that, like you said, you won't see on mainstream because they're trying to appeal to so many people. Whereas, hey, there's other people like me who like to really get into the nitty gritty and get down and dirty. But, you know, for whatever reason, that's not something you would see on the news, because if there's, you know, 100 people, 10 people might find it interesting, 90 people wouldn't, so they're not going to give it airtime. Right. But now you have podcasting, you have YouTube, you have all these different platforms now that are coming out, completely revolutionizing the way we do media. And I think, I mean, personally, I love it. You know, I love being able to kind of pick whatever I want to watch, whatever I want to listen to, and have it very specific, very tailor-made. And like you said, it's good for society because it gives a lot of value. You know, you turn on some random thing and hope to get a good investment idea. It can be hard sometimes, you know, but when somebody might be interested in China or Japan or, you know, discovery, like we've been talking about today, and they could see that title on there, click on it, and get way more information than they would have without the podcast being there. And that's how it can be so powerful.
And to add to that, if someone who's a podcast host listens to this episode, which, you know, a lot of listeners, you know, a lot of hosts are also podcast listeners, someone can make an episode saying, hey, you know, Eric's an idiot about discovery and he's totally wrong about this. And here's my view. That's kind of cool. You know, there's a lot more of that, you know, back and forth. You know, we can post this thing on Twitter and get comments and have debate, right? Because it's a market. You know, I don't necessarily have the truth, right? I'm just one guy on the internet and has an opinion and then has an idea. And clearly when I buy stock, someone's selling to me and they might have a different idea. So I think it provides more of a conversational intimacy, more so than you would get with radio, and certainly more than you would get with TV.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as somebody who is older in the room, shall we say, I remember the days of radio and, you know, having a, you know, I'm this old that I remember I had to get up off the couch to go change the channel on TV. So I know you guys don't know what that's like, but
no.
I remember what that was like. It was awful. And you only had three channels. And, you know, sometimes you had to move the rabbit ears on the TV to get the reception to come in. I mean, yeah, it was the dark ages for sure. But anyway, it's, you know, the opportunities to learn things. I mean, that's how I got into podcasting. Listening was the opportunity to learn stuff. You know, I love history, and I came across this history podcast called The History of Rome by Mike Duncan. And that would just open my eyes to this whole podcasting thing. And I was hooked, and I would listen to him at work. I would listen to him on my car. I'd listen to him when I was walking my dog. And, you know, it just became a thing for me. And yeah, there's so much opportunity for people to express their viewpoints, to learn things. And that's what I really like about it.
Yeah. And that's awesome. Yeah. And we're carving, you know, we're carving the future as we're all podcast hosts here, which I think is awesome, right? It's like, there's no rules in a sense, like we're literally creating the foundation. So it's cool to see how this is going to unfold over the next few decades. But my thesis, and, you know, we're recorded, so we're on record. My thesis is in 20 years, someone could watch this conversation, like if they only knew what was about to happen, you know, and they'll look at this as, you know, having to get off the couch to change the channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But probably. You probably thought that was cool, right? That you actually had a, right?
Oh yeah. No, yeah. I mean, you know, we had a black and white TV. And that was my first TV. So when they went to color, it was like, wow, this is a big deal. So yeah.
Hey, I remember my grandfather talking to me about being able to watch the World Series on TV, how cool that was.
Yeah. Yep. I was, when I worked in the restaurant business, I was talking to an employee once, and we were talking about some sitcom, and I said, I remember when it was on every Thursday night. She said, it was on once a week? She's like, how old are you? I don't know. So, yeah. No, I agree. So, how does this play into your idea with Lipson then? So is that really kind of where that took you?
Well, it was, so it was one of these situations. So I look at a lot of very tiny businesses and microcaps, and Lipson was this really interesting situation because here it was trading at about 1x earnings a few years ago. This is when the stock was at 1, it's now at around 4. And, you know, I saw all this growth ahead of it. But what was keeping it down, it was actually, so it was a spinoff. It was spun out of a company called Fab Universal, which was a Chinese business, which turned out to be a fraud. Speaking of, this goes full circle. And yeah, they had kiosks where you could like get like movies and shows and watch stuff. And it turned out that the kiosks either weren't, some of them weren't real, most of them didn't work. The entire business was made up, but they happened to own the company that owned Lipson. So when they spun it out, Fab Universal ended up going to zero. There was a whole lawsuit, and there's still litigation going on with the CEO and the CFO right now. And, you know, how much did they know? And it was a pretty heated public battle going on with the activists and the management. But it was so ridiculous that one time the CEO was paying himself, you know, with like option grants and incentives, it was going to be like 50% of the income was going to go to his pocket, which even then stock was still cheap, like, because it was a good business. But his name was Chris Spencer. So getting Chris Spencer off, getting the CFO, who's also making an egregious salary, getting them off, I think the stock's still super cheap. And there's the overhang, you know, they just filed an 8K, which was a total mess. nothing to be expected, but again, these microcaps, you know, any bit of news can send the stock one way or the other. So the stock sold off. You know, basically what happened, they had a restatement saying, hey, you know, the last few years of financials are going to be a little bit different. But if you'd been following the story, you already knew that was going to happen. And there was also the new CFO just resigned. So people got freaked out by that. But again, you know, here's a guy coming in to, you know, be the, you know, I don't know what the full story is, but you can imagine. Here's the CFO. He kind of comes in to take the place of this old, you know, horrible CFO. And now his entire job is like doing like financial restatements. I mean, that's got to be a miserable, and I don't think that's necessarily what he was signed up for. So people, I think, got freaked out by that. But, and then there's also there's a Chinese shareholder who's in jail right now, who owns a little over 30% of the stock that he got through the Fab Universal spinoff. So the company is now arguing that those shares were obtained illegally because it was from a fraudulent company. So they're asking a judge to cancel the shares. I don't know if they're going to win that lawsuit, but if they do, that's instantly, you know, a little over 30% of the shares outstanding go away overnight, which is, you know, right, you know, completely accredited to shareholders. So another one of these situations, there's a lot of ways you can win, a ton of uncertainty, and you're getting a high growth stock at a super low, you know, free cash flow multiple.
It honestly, it does sound scary though, and I would be worried about, you know, you talked about like melting ice cubes. This one sounds like a boiling pot of water, but you know, I guess that's why we diversify. And you gotta, if I think if you want to get something really, really cheap, you have to be able to weather some adversity. And so if this is stuff that's already expected, you're going to get in at a cheap price. And then that's where you can get the double, triple, quadruple 10 baggers from something that people found out it's not as bad as it seemed.
Yeah, I mean, there was even a comment. There was some comments online of, you know, oh, well, so they just did this pipe deal to raise some money to make an acquisition. They just bought AdvertiseCast. And people were annoyed that it was a pipe deal. And I was like, well, why did the activists do the pipe deal? And, you know, why didn't they
What's a pipe deal? Can you explain that just for a second?
It's basically a private raise of capital as opposed to just, you know, selling equity. And people, you know, someone online recently was accusing the activists of, you know, self-dealing and all this, you know, stuff. It's like, well, no, you can't really be selling equity when you don't even know what the financials are. You know, so, you know, that was not the ideal situation. But, you know, the thing's a mess right now. So they got to clean up the numbers. Once they clean that up, I mean, here's what I think will probably happen. They'll clean it up, grow the business, and then they'll sell it to someone. You know, because that company, again, you know, would you know, you have 80,000 people using it. You have a larger company that can cut the cost dramatically, you know, improve the cost structure. That would be ripe for a buyer, but they're not going to, I don't think they would sell it until they clean the numbers up, get a new CEO, show a few years of growth, and then sell it. That's what I would do. But you're looking, you know, yeah, but I mean, you know, right now at a $4 stock, I mean, even in a normal valuation for, you know, those kinds of companies, you know, it would probably be like $7 or $8. They could probably get in the sale right now if they wanted to sell right now. But if they grow the company for a few years, you know, you're potentially looking at a, you know, $15-$20 stock. And I mean, I got in at one, so I've been buying up.
If they have numbers, that's the key thing, right? If
they have numbers. They do have numbers. It's I mean, these restatements aren't going to be gigantic. A lot of it is just had to do with like the taxes and the old CFO not accounting for taxes properly and all that. No, I mean, they're a very profitable company. They're a wonderful business. Yeah, there's no question they're profitable. Yeah. If I made it seem like that, that's not the issue. These are very minute technicalities of just what do we owe in taxes? They're a very profitable business. Okay. So it's what Monish Pabrai would say, you know, low risk, high uncertainty. Low risk, high uncertainty.
Heads I win, tails I don't lose that much.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
So, Eric, thank you very much for joining us tonight. So, for any of those out there that would like to learn more about you and kind of what you do, where can they go to find more about you?
They can go to gscm.co, which is my website for Granite State Capital Management. They can also just contact me either through Twitter or through Instagram. Very active on both. And if you're into steak, you'd like my Instagram as well. And both my handles is Eric Schlein, it's ERIC S-C-H-L-E-I-E-N. You know, people don't always want to spell it, so if you want to put it in the show notes.
I will.
For people, I appreciate it.
Yep, absolutely.
But I'm very available, and I respond to all messages. So even if you just have a question or, hey, can you talk to me about blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm not going to give you stock advice, but I'm always happy to answer investment-related questions.
Awesome. Well, again, I thank you very much for coming to talk to us and spending some time and helping educate us on investing abroad, how to avoid fraud in China, and more information about Time Warner and Discovery, as well as Lipson, and all the great knowledge you share with us. Plus Andrew's comments about the steak, that was kind of worth the podcast alone. So
my pleasure. Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, thanks, Eric.
Out.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day.